Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Mary and Melissa Show. This is Mary, and Melissa can't be with us today, unfortunately, but that's all right. I've got control of the mic, and it's all going to be awesome. We have an awesome show today, talking about one of my favorite topics, mental health. That was the Ramones, by the way, for those of you who might follow that kind of stuff. We had a great song called Psychotherapy. This show is not just about psychotherapy, but it's about the overall big umbrella topic, mental health for kids. Where do they get a lot of their mental health services? In schools. The lucky ones do. A lot of kids, not so lucky. We have a very nice conversation that we're going to start with two brilliant individuals. From the National Association of School Psychologists. They are frequent contributors to our show, which is actually the Mary and Melissa Show, which is part of Inclusion Zone. It is a 501c3 and sanctioned, blessed, and all anointed by the IRS. And we bring this show to everyone as a public service because we, Mary and Melissa, are parents of kids with a variety of different special needs, disabilities, whatever is your favorite word to use. And we're sick of everybody reinventing the ball. So this is a show where we encapsulate all the greatest minds and deliver it free to you all out there so that you can learn from everyone who comes on our show. And we only have the best. And the best today includes Dr. Eric Rossin, who is a former guest on this show, which makes him already terrific. He is the Director of Professional Development and Standards, again, for the National Association of School Psychologists. And we have Dr. Kelly Valancourt-Strobach, Director of Government Relations, also for the National Association of School Psychologists. We will now call that NASP. All right, so let's get them on the line here and start our conversation, which is going to include such things as why is mental health provided in schools in the first place? So let's get them on the line. Drs. Rossin and Dr. Valancourt, are you with me?
Yes, we're here.
Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning. Fantastic. Welcome to the show. We're so pleased to have you. Smart minds who have dedicated your lives to psychology, particularly the psychology that is delivered in schools to help our kids. So thank you so very much for that.
Thanks for having us.
All right.
You're welcome. And I just think you guys are great, the National Association of School Psychologists. I know it sounds for some folks way too wonky, but, you know, it's where it's at. These are the folks who really make sure that this mental health thing occurs in our schools across our nation. I want to start, though, with a conversation with, okay, mental health in schools. It's kind of a little bit controversial. So can one of you take us back to how did this thing of providing mental health services start in schools?
So I'll start with this. This is Kelly. So if we want to put a marker on it, I guess you could really look at, so when, back in 1975, when Congress passed Public Law 94-142, it was at that time called the Education for All Handicapped Children Act. It's now the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. But that was the first time where we really, you know, as a nation, we said it's really important to start providing these types of services, comprehensive supportive services to students in all of our schools. Kind of prior to that time, and it still continued, you know, after the passage of this law, but we saw essentially two separate school systems. We saw public schools that educated kids who didn't have significant needs, and then we saw other schools where our kids with more significant physical and emotional disabilities were served. So they weren't always served in the same school building. So after 1975, that was really when, I guess you could say, the idea of providing comprehensive services in schools started, that there became kind of federal mandates and money tied behind that. And then it's over the past 30 years, it's gone through a number of changes. But, you know, we see now, you know, really it became, I think now it's one of the things that we recognize is here to stay. And No Child, when No Child Left Behind was passed in 2002, you know, there's a lot of people that say that there's a lot of things that a lot of people don't like about that law. But one of the really great things was that it, for the first time, really spelled out that it is important that we provide comprehensive services to all students. So not just students who have a disability or who are receiving special education and might need mental health support. That law really recognized the wealth of research that shows having comprehensive mental health and social emotional learning and social skills supports, all of those preventative and early intervention services are important to learning, and schools need to make efforts to, you know, to incorporate those services. And so, you know, here we are, 2015, we're still talking about how to do it really, really well. But I don't, you know, the conversation has shifted from why do we need to have these in schools to how can we do it better?
Got it. Okay. So prior to 1975, you're kind of on your own. If you're having a mental health crisis, you know, the law passes, and along with that, kids who have a diagnosis get services, and presumably there's a better screening system or identification, I guess you should say, for those services. So since mental health is sort of the stepchild of, I don't know, the disability world, if you will, because you can't see it often, I would imagine back in those early days, a lot of students went undiagnosed. Could you talk about that, either Dr. Rossman or Dr. Valancourt?
So I'll start, and then Eric can jump in. I'd say, you know, one of the things, at least, you know, if we're looking back, in, you know, in the 70s and the 80s, there were a lot of kids that probably were misdiagnosed. A lot of times, what we consider externalizing behavior, so you can kind of walk into a classroom and pick out who those kids are. Less of the internalizing behaviors like depression and anxiety that are kind of harder to pick up. But it wasn't so much that, so I think it was kids were underdiagnosed, but they were also misdiagnosed. A lot of times, you know, we've gotten a lot better at identifying, and I hate to use this term, it's not technical at all, but identifying the difference between a bad kid and a kid that has some mental health issues. We used to see a lot of kids being expelled from public schools or being put into a special school because they didn't, you know, they thought that he was willfully behaving in a certain way when really it was he had undiagnosed and unaddressed mental health needs.
Yeah, and I'll jump onto that. You know, I think with all the changes that occurred in 1975 and then since, you know, the field has evolved and evolution occurs very slowly. So for a time, not only did we not understand mental health and behavioral health the way we do now, but there weren't the school-employed professionals that had the training necessary at the time the way we have today. The beauty about having school-employed professionals, and I know we're talking about how and why we provide in the schools, but folks like school psychologists, school social workers, school counselors, there are people who have training in, you know, psychology and mental and behavioral health, but also have training in education and how the two intersect. So really, it's been an evolution of understanding kids, understanding behavior, understanding mental health, and an evolution of how people are trained and having the professionals in place to appropriately identify and provide those services.
Okay, that makes sense. And so we're a couple of decades into this wonderful development of kids getting what they need, hopefully. Let's just sort of talk about where we are. I've heard a lot about, you know, kids have a lot of issues. I just read a statistic, 1 in 5 children have a diagnosable mental disorder, that 60% or so of adolescents have mental health disorders, that they don't get treatment. so, you know, you hear about those types of things, and you think, okay, so it's not 1975, it's 2015. Yeah, it's better, but heck, sure sounds like there's a lot of work to be done. So give us a sort of state of the state, if you will, on kids getting services, whether they have a disability already coming into the school system or getting diagnosed while in the school system. Can you describe this for us?
Sure. So, that statistic is a common one that's cited, the 1 in 5. One of the issues with that statistic is that it does not properly capture all the students that are in need of mental or behavioral health services to get the most from learning or to excel in school that don't have full-blown pathology or symptomatology that would lead to a full-blown diagnosis. So one of the big things that's been talking about a lot, and NASP is hosting a public policy institute in a few weeks on the topic of trauma. And we know that, this is just an example, but we know lots of kids experience adversity, stress in their lives. A small percentage of them, maybe 15 to 20%, will ever develop full-blown diagnosable trauma. But many of those kids are still experiencing distress and would really benefit from services. So focusing simply on students that have identified disabilities in need of mental health is something that we've been trying to move away from. And the law that Kelly was speaking about has also tried to move away from that too by allowing some funds to go to preventive services. So kind of the state of the state right now is we are still trying to think about how special education and general education work together to provide a spectrum of services. So we're making sure that the school is a very safe, welcoming place that is that promotes a healthy environment, healthy behavior, healthy social interactions, where a place where kids feel connected. And then there are services for kids in general education. So if they have a grandmother or grandfather that they were very close with pass away, we don't want to have to identify them as having a disability because they're grieving to provide mental health services to them. And then we want to be able to have some medium intensity services. And then for students with disabilities that require very long-term intensive services, we need to have those too. And we need to be sure that those services are somehow integrated with the education system as well. So we need people that are working with that student but also working with that teacher and understand the context of that school and are able to observe them in various contexts within their school setting. So that's the current state. We have a long way to go. I don't think schools are always positioning themselves well to provide this full range of services as we see would be ideal. Mm-hmm. And I'll let Kelly jump in at that point.
Yeah. Well, Kelly, if you could also just, when you do, can you talk, though, also about the, schools are supposed to also only provide services related to accessing the curriculum. So can you, in your state of the state statement about how that it's a strength, but it's also quite a limitation sometimes in the service provision of services.
So I completely agree with everything that Eric said. And one, to speak to your, I wouldn't say that schools are limited in providing services that are, only related to the curriculum, but in a way they're related to student learning. You know, that is the mission of schools, is to promote student learning and, improve student outcomes and overall school success. And when you have this full continuum of services, you really are making sure that every student, when they're in that school, is engaged in learning. So one of the, and I think one of the ways that we've changed over the past couple of years, but one thing that still represents a challenge is getting people, the population as a whole, to instead of, you know, right now, you know, most people, when you think of mental health services, you probably have a stereotype, and you think of somebody sitting on a couch, talking to a person, you know, getting therapy, someone that's got really significant needs. And we really need to think of mental health as a continuum. That is, promoting mental wellness, providing services for those kids that are at risk and could really just benefit from resiliency building, and also making sure we're addressing kids that have those most significant needs. And so there's a lot of research that shows incorporating social-emotional learning, skill-building groups, what Eric mentioned, you know, you can create safe school environments that are trauma-sensitive. So that, you know, it means that kids walk in the door and they just, they feel supported. They know that the adults in the building care about them, that if they have a problem, they can go talk to somebody about it and get help. And that help could be 5 minutes of sitting with the school counselor to just complain about how your morning was bad, or, you know, more systemic long-term, you know, individualized attention. But all, you know, all of these services, regardless of the intensity in school, ensure that when the kid is in the classroom, he's there ready to learn. He's not, you know, he's not fuming over an anger issue, you know, about something that's happening in the home or in his community. He's not anxious about, you know, whatever is making him anxious. Basically, we give the kids an outlet to deal with their emotions and deal with the issues that are going on in their life to help them get through their school day. You know, in the same way, you know, as adults, we can self-select. You know, we probably take breaks during the day to call one of our friends or to call our parent or just spend 5 minutes getting something off of our chest so that we can then go back and do our jobs at work. It's, you can think of it kind of in that way. That's some of the services that are provided to school, in schools for kids, is to make sure that they, when they're in that seat in the classroom, they're accessing the knowledge.
Yeah. And I'll add one more piece to your original question, is acknowledging the reality that a lot of, you know, superintendents and executive administration for school districts have metrics for how they're viewed as being successful as a school. And right now, academics are still number one, and mental health and social outcomes are not even really measured a lot. And so people that are able to provide mental health services in schools are often on the chopping block. This is not anything new. Unfortunately, there's this conflict because at the same time, the education laws and all the research has long recognized the relationship between mental health and learning. I mean, for me, and I don't know if it's like this for you, but I need a lot of conditions for me to actually function, even to write a good email. I mean, not only does my office need to be the right temperature, I need to have had breakfast, my coffee, if my kids were keeping me up the night before, forget it. So there's, and I feel safe at work. Now, if on my way to work I was afraid, if when I got there the rooms were too hot or too cold, I didn't feel like anyone at work cared about me or even noticed if I was there or not, if my computer wasn't working properly or the tools I had were not up to date, I can't imagine functioning well. And so it's unfortunately still viewed as extracurricular in a lot of ways, yeah. But it's really prerequisite to learning.
Yeah, it is really astounding given the research that is out there. Gosh, any number of ways to go in this discussion, but I guess, Dr. Rawson, you said schools are not positioning themselves, not all schools are positioning themselves to avail themselves to providing this continuum of services. So I'd like to understand why, especially if that is an evidence-based practice that, you know, that this is the best way that schools should be organized. And then secondly, though, we got to talk about the money piece. Is this a cost-prohibitive practice to think about everybody, you know, from Johnny who skinned his knee walking into the school building to the kid who's bipolar, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, those are two very large pieces I'll let Kelly actually talk about the funding piece. But when I mentioned not positioning themselves, what I mean is that they allocate their resources and time to not teaching children, to just teaching the curriculum. And I find that is two very different things. Teaching children requires that you're attending to all of their needs and recognizing what they need to learn. Teaching the curriculum is the other thing. And this is not any indictment on teachers, because a lot of teachers in a lot of schools I worked in were extremely committed and talented and overwhelmed. And what I found was, too many times we had a kid who simply couldn't read, and they were behaving really poorly, and they would just give them more reading time, and they were experiencing toxic stress at home and in their community, and the instruction was not being helpful, but they just saying, well, they just need more curriculum and more drilling, and we need to hire more reading teachers, or we need to bring in new textbooks. And
right.
I would sit and have conversations. I'd say, this kid needs to feel like we care. This kid needs to feel like reading is actually going to be important to him, because right now what's important to him is just surviving and not looking like a fool in front of his peers in class. Unfortunately, I would always get, We need to show progress. This is our, and I would say we'll get there if you allocate resources to mental health. But it takes a bit of a leap of faith to do that, because it's a step removed to someone who doesn't know better. So schools are often not positioning themselves because they're not allocating resources and funds to hiring school-employed mental health professionals, to ensuring that kids are accessing a range of services, whether it's counseling or some school-wide programs, whether they're changing discipline policies, and they're not also using social skills curriculum, which is something that we know, you know, the research has shown for a long time has a huge effect on academic outcomes.
Yeah. Let me just dive into something, though, you just said, which just really makes me crazy. How are we still having people running schools where this idea of the primacy of mental health is questioned? Now, I know that we are in the world of Common Core and the park and all that, and maybe that's just the answer. But how come we haven't had enough of a cultural change? What's stopping that?
I don't think that it's the people running the schools that, like, you know, the principals and the superintendents. I think they legitimately understand the importance of mental health and the importance of these prevention programs. I think where they're stuck between a rock and a hard place is when they're doing their budgets and, you know, they're answering to the school board, or they're answering to, you know, the people want to see results and they want to see it immediately. And it's much harder to make the case for investing millions of dollars into making sure you've got enough school psychologists and school counselors and school social workers to provide all these great services, because in 10 years you're going to see some really great results, because we're going to have this great prevention program and we're going to have less students in special education because we got to them early. We're going to have kids that, you know, our dropout rate's going to increase. Like, they can't really wrap their heads around the value of that kind of investment, because they can't use that as a great talking point. Whereas you know, going around and saying, well, we hired 14 new reading specialists, and, you know, by the end of the year, we're going to see a full grade of reading growth. It's a lot easier to justify, I think, investments when you're going to see an immediate outcome or when it's in reaction to something that's happened. And so, for example, you know, following Newtown, a lot of schools all of a sudden did say, oh, my gosh, you know, we need to do better about addressing school safety and addressing mental health. But they went about it in a way that kind of just put a Band-Aid on the problem. And it was, we're going to make sure we've got resources for our kids with the most intense needs. They still kind of ignored, you know, a lot of things that Eric was talking about, the prevention and early intervention stuff that builds a system and a community that's safe. And so I think it's going to take a paradigm shift on many, many levels to get people to understand that investments in prevention are worthwhile. Yeah. And I am hoping, this is my personal opinion, so don't take this for anything other than it's my opinion. You know, there's a lot of movement now in education to kind of move away from this focus on standardized tests and have that be the only metric of school success. And so I am hopeful that if we can get over that and we can move away from, you know, the SOLs or the whatever each state calls their end of year standardized tests being like the one measure of you had a great school year, that might help shift the focus on just how holistically do we make conducive to student learning, which includes having comprehensive mental health.
And I want to add one thing as well. Well, actually, before I do, I don't know if you wanted to chime in, Mary.
No, please. Well, I guess what I would want to go to is, I want to play devil's advocate then, because I'm sure there are folks who would say something along the lines of, well, golly, you know, schools are where you go to learn. And if you've got any of those issues, maybe you don't belong in that school, okay? Or get yourself some insurance, or can't you get on that Obamacare and get your kids some mental health stuff? I don't know why I have an accent right now. I could do it in a New York accent, too. But the point is, hey, there's, you know, school's where you go to learn. You got a problem with learning, well, get, you know, you don't get your operations when you bust up your knee, you know, in the school. So go get your head examined somewhere else.
We hear that a lot, actually. Eric may have a different argument, but
yeah.
What?
I was going to say, and maybe they even sound like this. Do they have a good accent like me? I don't know.
I'm from the South, so I'm used to that accent when I hear lots of arguments. We say back to them, you know, yes, the role of schools is to teach kids and teach kids to learn, but if that kid is not available to learn, the school can't do their job. And so, you know, a lot of people do think that that's not the role of schools, but if you look back to kind of why we started the school breakfast and free lunch program, kids cannot learn if they are hungry. And so it's another aspect that has to be addressed in order for students to learn. And
right.
So that is why it is important that we provide these services
right.
to kids at school.
Why do we do vision and hearing screenings? Why do we do those lice checks?
Mm-hmm.
Why do we have a school nurse? Again, this goes along with what Kelly was saying. But I think most importantly, it's where kids go.
Yeah.
Schools are a community center, really. And, or rather I should say center of the community when it comes to
yeah.
kids. And there's so many barriers to kids accessing mental health services, even if they're insured, that they're just not going to get it. And you'd be hard pressed to find someone that would say kids shouldn't be getting those services. Now, those people are saying, well, it shouldn't be in schools, but the truth is, for as long as we've been tracking it, the majority of kids that need mental health services don't get them outside school. There's so many barriers to accessing it. Now, the services in the community are great, and anyone who can access them should. They can be very helpful and very supportive. The problem is, again, most kids aren't getting them. And the majority of kids that do get mental health services get them in schools. Some new research has found that even getting some initial mental health support services in schools substantially increases the likelihood that they'll get more services outside of school later on if they need it. So
is this a parent issue? I mean, are we fighting upstream because parents don't understand the kids' needs, that they don't ask enough for help for their kids? I mean, I've been, you know, we've been talking about teachers and principals and school administrators, but, you know, what about the parents? Because I guess if Johnny needs to get mental health assistance in the community, he's going to have to get a ride from his mom or dad or somebody.
Right.
So is this a family issue more than a school issue?
Well, there's two kind of barriers when it comes to families. Some families, like you said, recognize the need and want to pursue it, but A, don't realize the school can provide it, or B, can't logistically find a way to get those services after school. In the district I worked in, a lot of parents, single parents, had two jobs, several children, couldn't afford it, couldn't send their 9-year-old on two buses to get home at 8 p.m. So there's some stigma sometimes. I mean, I was threatened to be beaten up in the parking lot by a parent who probably would have successfully done so if we didn't deal with that situation, but only because I had offered to do a learning assessment. But just the idea that I was a school psychologist, he viewed that as a like an insult to his family.
Right.
It was somehow saying that they were lesser in a way, or that's my guess. We were able to, like I said, address it later on. So I think that is one piece of it. I mean, I don't know if...
Well, I think some of it is, in addition to the logistical piece of it, you know, a lot of times there is work. You know, they can't fathom how they're going to get, how they're going to manage all their schedules, plus get so-and-so to a doctor's appointment. But even in that case, it goes beyond even that, I think, is in the district that I worked in, which is not that far. Eric and I did not work that far apart, but probably worked in two completely different worlds in some respects. But for a lot of our families, it was a 6-month wait to get into any kind of mental health services because we didn't have enough providers in the community to address those students' needs outside of school, where the parent is, you know, their kid's desperate. They need anything. And they're like, we can't wait 6 months to get, you know, to get into a screening with a doctor. And so at that point, they become, you know, the family's then left with nothing if they don't really understand what's available at the school. And I do think some schools do a really, really great job at providing a ton of information to parents about how to navigate the system. Other areas, I think, could do a little bit better job because a lot of times parents, it's not a parent problem. It's just it's a problem that the parents don't understand what's out there and the various ways to get into the system of mental health care.
I'd like to make one very important clarification as well, Mary.
Mm-hmm.
My clarification is that the mental health services that Kelly and I are referring to in schools go beyond what many people are thinking. It goes beyond a kid sitting down once or twice a week for 30 minutes or 45 minutes and talking. What can be provided in schools when kids are there in real time is a full range of services. So it's not necessarily just scheduled counseling sessions or group counseling, which can also be provided. But it's also drop-ins. It's also, if a kid is in serious distress in that moment, they have somewhere to go. It's that we are actually working with the teacher, so the teacher knows the strategies that are helpful for that kid all throughout the day. We are working on setting up their environments or addressing the transitions that are maybe causing a lot of problems for them. And so that's another thing that, like I said, having school-employed professionals that understand education and how it works and recognize the intersection with learning, where all those services can be provided. And I'm sure Kelly can attest to this. But, again, when I was in school and I was working with kids, it came to a point where I would just get drop-ins and kids would come in and say, you know, I am in total distress. I mean, literally kids would say, I'm about to cut myself. And if I said, well, you know, wait till your appointment in 2 weeks, that's insufficient.
Right.
And
that
there are times where you're walking down the hall.
Dr. Valancourt, what were you going to say?
In along the same vein with Eric, you know, if you have someone in the school every day that knows these kids, I've been walking down the hall, you know, in between class change, and a kid just looks at you, and you know who that kid is, and you look at their teacher, and you take them immediately. They don't even have to worry about going into the classroom, having an issue, and then having to leave. And so there are many more opportunities to get those kids as soon as they have an issue if you have people in the school.
I agree, and I would I could be wrong on this, but perhaps the school that you even worked at, and you don't even have to go and say it, but it's probably a general education school. I mean, most of these kids, you don't need to be in a special ed school to have these types of crises. I mean, this happens up at your local school. And one of the things that I've heard folks say about, you know, your general public school up the street is that, well, it's not a, you know, no, we don't do that because we don't have enough folks on hand because, no, we're not a behavioral health center. We're not a therapeutic school. And I think folks like that should just be given a pink slip because by nature you are, you know, you need to be therapeutic in everything that you do. And so that drives me crazy. That's my little soliloquy. But you know what? I want to just challenge you both, though, for a second. You both are so tremendous and eloquent. Maybe your profession needs a little makeover, if you will. First of all, Dr. Rothen, I'm sure you could have taken that parent. I'm sure that would have been an easy battle. We got to make the couch cool. Maybe that's your phrase. Maybe the couch is cool, or maybe we come up with something. But you got to be like, I don't know, you got to be on the sides of a bus or something. I just pulled this up. The American Journal of Psychiatry reported that there was an increase in men seeking psychiatric services because of The Sopranos. They're tying it to The Sopranos, but it increased by 2 million after The Sopranos aired. They think it was because of them. Maybe you need a reality show. Maybe you need a TV show. I don't know. But we got to make this de rigueur, you know. We got to make, you got an issue, you know, it's no big whoop. You go down, you chat it out, you're done, you know. I know there's all the stigma. Enough with the stigma, enough with the thought that you guys are some, you know, hocus-pocus people. And also, if I would just, furthermore, with the difficulties of families with seeking services also outside, is guess what? If you want to go talk it out, fine. You could go see a licensed clinical social worker or a psychologist, but if you still need medication, that's a whole other appointment. So now you're, like, doubling it up. So I guess what my point is that, you know, we need to really make this easier on families. These are families who already have a lot of issues, whether it's, you know, they just having a kid with a disability or going through crisis. That's tough enough. What kind of cool, sexy things do you guys do to, like, make this, the hot topic at cocktail parties?
Well, for one, your radio show is a good start.
Absolutely right.
Obviously, thank you for having it.
Yeah. This is the best thing that you could be doing. Yes. Okay. And then
absolutely,
and beyond this.
Absolutely. So the next best thing. Yeah. I think for one, to some degree, you're right. I mean, we're fighting against some preconceived thoughts and schema about what mental and behavioral health services are and what psychologists do.
And what mental illnesses,
right.
Even.
Right. So to some degree, in the end, it comes down to the fact that we're there to help kids and families in any way that we can and help schools meet their needs in any way we can. A lot of times our services are helping other educators in the school meet the mental health needs of their kids while they're in the classroom, or help avoid having to kick them out of the classroom, because there's a good strategy that will probably work most of the time. Now, when it comes to that parent in the parking lot, to some degree, there was a cultural component to that, and there was also, admittedly, some of my fault in not introducing myself properly and not talking about what I do. And so I do think that anyone that – and that was my first year, by the way. I was like 3 months into my first year. I think anyone that works with families, we sometimes need to check ourselves and realize that it's very scary when you're talking about – when a parent's talking about their kids. And there's anyone suggesting that something's wrong or that they need help. And being sensitive to that is so, so important.
Yeah.
And I think it's also, we as school site, we do as much as we can with the schools and the families that we work with to, spread the message that there's asking for help is not a bad thing. There's still, I think, between, children, youth, and adults sometimes have a hard time admitting that they're not perfect or that, that they're struggling with something. And just, helping families understand that it is totally okay to come into the school and say, I'm really struggling with how to deal with my kid.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean – it doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you. It doesn't mean that you're a bad parent. It just means, like every other parent, that you need some help. And, that's a lot of times the first step in changing people's minds about what mental and behavioral health services are and what school psychologists do. It's just, we can help you.
But you're probably right. We do need a show on Bravo or something. I think that
there was a school psychologist at the DC area.
There was a school psychologist on The Bachelor a long time ago.
Oh, she was.
I'm not admitting to watching it. I'm just saying I know one was on there. But other than that, school psychologists are not really in the public eye.
We should be more.
Yeah.
We got to think about this. We'll come up with a pitch. We'll write the one pager.
Right.
Yeah, no, I could see this. I mean, kids talking about their issues. It's sort of like back in the day, what was the MTV show with all those kids living in a house together and they all...
Oh, the real world.
The real world, yeah.
Real world, there you go, bam. So we just need to have like a counselor there. Dr. Drew Pinsky or Eric Rossin,
yeah.
Dr. Paul Valancourt. I think... all right, well, this is the beginning of a series of conversations that we're going to have that's going to get to, not to the bottom of this, but reveal the warts of the system that we have in place in schools, some of the joys that we have, because there definitely are some, the ongoing issues, and especially in light of the anniversary of the ADA that's coming up, the 25th, which is really significant. We have to keep that in mind. So each day that passes, we know that there are kids who need help, and schools are the most important part of helping kids these days. So until we live under a different kind of society, this is the game. That's the game we got. So Dr. Rossin and Dr. Valancourt, I want to thank you both so much for what you do and for your time. Sharing your smarts, and we'll get on this topic again real soon. Thank you.
Sounds good. Thanks, Mary.
Thank you.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, so that was a terrific conversation with our dear friend from the National Association of School Psychologists about kids and therapy in schools, and, it really shouldn't be a stigma. Because we all have stuff. We've got baggage. Kids got baggage, and they're little folks, and they have a tough time. We got to make sure that everybody is organized, just as we're organized to make sure that they can get the best out of their reading, the best out of their math, make sure that they get the best out of their mental health, because they could be the best reader, best mathematician, but if they can't be behaviorally sound, then it's all for naught. So, all right, everyone, thank you for listening to the Mary and Melissa Show, a project of Inclusion Zone, one of the best 501c3s out there, broadcasting straight from the nation's capital. Find us please, on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We're everywhere, inclusionzone.org. Thank you.
Thank you.